Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the next hour. KBOO is coming to the close of our fourth annual All Thrills and No Frills campaign. We've hosted lots of special programming for you, including musical marathons and specials for Black History Month and Women's International Day. You can view the schedule at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And while you're there, and if you are able, please click on the donate button and support your community radio station. If there is one single issue that has animated the far right in this country above all others, it is the issue of immigration. The current administration came to power partly on stoking nativist fears that waves of immigrants will take our jobs, strain our resources, rape and murder our people, and pollute our blood. Today, the Moles take a deeper dive into how immigration is largely driven by U.S. intervention abroad to make the global South safe for U.S. corporate profit-making. I'll speak with Luisa Martinez about her experiences growing up poor and undocumented, and how discovering the sordid history behind Latino migration to the U.S. gave her a new sense of dignity as an immigrant Latina. We'll also hear from Moles Fran Michelle and Lori Mercier about the classic film El Norte, which reveals the horrific conditions in Guatemala under an agricultural corporate regime and the hoax of the American dream for immigrants who flee to the North. We'll close our show with excerpts from an essay by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, which examines how migrants to the U.S. become part of the project to obscure the U.S. settler colonial past and present. U.S. imperial intervention, particularly in Latin America, benefits the global North in a number of ways, like the ready extraction of natural resources and the creation of vast markets for U.S. goods. But the resulting immiseration of populations in the global South also creates a pool of cheap and docile workers, the migrants who flood our borders seeking safety and economic security. Luisa Martinez and her family were part of the migration north. Today, she talks about her past as an undocumented person and how becoming a socialist brought her a fresh perspective on the capitalist dynamics of migration from poor countries to the wealthy. I have with me today Luisa Martinez to talk about her personal experience growing up as an undocumented person and how becoming a socialist brought her a sense of dignity as an immigrant from the global South to the global North. Luisa Martinez is a member of Portland DSA and the National Political Committee of DSA. She's been involved with organizing for immigrants' rights for 15 years. Welcome to KBOO and to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Luisa Martinez.
Thank you, Patricia.
You published an article entitled How Socialism Brought Me Dignity as an Undocumented Person. You wrote about how you were born in Chile and were brought by your family to Florida at an early age, and then you grew up in Florida as an undocumented person. I wanted to start by asking you what it was like growing up undocumented.
Well, I'll say it's a complicated story of how my family arrived to the United States. But basically, the only reason why we were able to get a visa is because my grandpa was working in a restaurant. He befriended an embassy worker. And so it was just kind of a favor that we were even able to access a visa, honestly. But like many immigrants, you know, that visa expired and then we stayed. In the article, in terms of what it was like growing up being undocumented, I share a couple of stories. You know, there were lots of times where I was taken advantage of, you know, as a worker. And so I could only work under the table jobs. And so I wasn't able to legally drive, which meant I took 3 buses to work, you know, utilizing a transportation system that's very underfunded and inadequate for the population in South Florida. So just to give you an example, one of my jobs that I had for a while, it took maybe 45 minutes to get there by car, and it took me 2.5 hours. But that's what a lot of people deal with, right? Like, it was just what was available to me at the time. You know, one story I didn't share in the article, a couple stories, was I actually had two bosses that just refused to pay me for different reasons. One was Hillary's Deli in West Palm Beach, Florida. I will say this was 20 years ago. So I'm sure they have new management, but that one, I explained, you know, my situation, and I'm undocumented, and he's like, that's fine. And so I only worked there for a couple of days, maybe 4 or 5 days. And then I went to just ask for my salary, which I want to make clear, for tip workers in Florida, I think it was like $2.25, maybe an hour, that tip workers got paid. So it's very, very little. And I asked him, like, hey, could I have my pennies, please? And he's like, well, I'm not paying you. You don't pay taxes. And so he just refused to pay me. He's like, you can just work off tips. And so that was one place. Another place, but it was a Jewish deli. And that one, I was pretty lucky. That one was pretty close to where I lived. And so, like I said, tip workers got paid $2.25 or something like that. And I just happened to be working there when the wage went up a dollar. So a whopping $3.25 or something like that, right? And they were paying me the hourly, but then they didn't give me the raise. And I asked the other workers, like, if they had gotten an increase, and they said yes. And so I printed an article showing that the tip wage had increased and that they were stiffing me, honestly. And so I print that out, I gave it to them, and I said that I quit. And so one of the owners called me later that day. She was livid. And again, she's like, well, you don't pay taxes. I was like, well, it doesn't mean that you don't get to pay me. And I would love to pay taxes. And furthermore, it's one kind of tax. Immigrants still pay every other kind of tax you can imagine, right?
So their justification was that because you weren't paying taxes, they didn't have to pay you as much.
An hourly wage, yeah. Which, like I said, was not a lot of money. I just want to say there were other instances too, stuff like sexual harassment, but I barely put it in the article because I feel like every woman worker deals with that. Mm-hmm. You know, the point that I make is that my vulnerability in that moment just meant that I just kind of had to take it. I felt like I had, who was I going to talk to? The police? Like, get out of here.
There were other consequences too that you write about because you were very keen on going on to college. I mean, you talk in the article about what that meant for you.
Yeah, there was other, I mean, the psychological kind of things I talk about is just associating being Latin American with poverty in my situation. And I come from a family that's very uneducated. I was the first one to graduate high school in my family. And so I wasn't really taught, for instance, about the long shadow that the U.S. government has cast, not just in Latin America, but for the global South. And so I associate it with shame, being Latin American with shame. And I internalized this kind of guilt, the kind of narratives that you hear about undocumented workers that we're taking from other people, et cetera, which was, again, I didn't make the choice to come to the United States, but even the people who do make that choice, it's for very good reasons. And it's because opportunities are not available in their home country. And so, you know, what I didn't know was why we'd come here. And I didn't know why there was such a large Latin American community in the United States.
You then, still as an undocumented person, tried to enroll in community college. And tell us what happened then.
I tried more than once. And so they basically told me that they weren't accepting anybody on a tourist visa or even expired visa because of the second 9/11, because of the hijackers with the Twin Towers. And so it didn't matter that I graduated from Florida schools. That wasn't enough to be able to enroll me. The only option that was available to me was enrolling as an international student, which is multiple times the tuition rate, which might as well have been $1,000,000,000. Like, it wasn't accessible to me as a, you know, given how much money it was to go to school. You know, you don't have access to loans, right? I didn't have access to financial aid until I got my paperwork.
And how old were you when you finally got your papers?
So I was just shy of my 21st birthday.
I recall that was a process that took some 18 years or something. It was hideously complicated, and there were more opportunities for your family to be exploited and their money taken and get nothing back for it.
Yeah. So My grandfather tried three times to get to kind of start the process. The first time, the person who maybe probably wasn't an attorney just robbed him, didn't do anything for us. They just kind of took his money. Second time, the person died, you can believe, which is just unfortunate for everybody involved, right? And then the third time we were successful. So that happened under IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, under Reagan of all people. So that was amnesty. So that's a little bit different in that it didn't matter how you came to the United States. Everybody was afforded an opportunity if you met certain standards to be able to apply for citizenship. But that's extremely rare.
People don't have access to that option now.
No, and actually most people who cross the border undocumented, not through a port of entry, it's really not available. Adjustment of your legal status really isn't available to you. So for a lot of people, the door is not even the door's not open. And even when it is, it takes a very, very long time. And so the process was my grandfather, he applied for his residency, and then you have to wait 5 years and then you can apply for citizenship. But all of this costs money. And for somebody who doesn't speak English, for the type of person that doesn't really understand bureaucracies, is not educated, that's a lot more intimidating than like an educated middle class person.
Okay, so you get your papers, and then how did your life change?
Well, I could finally go to school, which was the most important thing, which, you know, I identified as one way, really the only way of being able to get out of the cyclical poverty that my family kind of experienced. You know, I was tired of working all these jobs and I just didn't want to struggle anymore. So yeah, I went to school, and so I eventually made it to the University of Florida for, was it my bachelor's and then eventually my master's too.
The kind of the common narrative about why people immigrate is that those countries down there in the global south are poor and they're poorly run and they're corrupt and they're violent. And of course, people want to come and take advantage of all the opportunity that's in America. So it's this blaming kind of narrative. And you're in school, and at some point you encounter the ideas of socialism and you get an exposure to a different narrative. So talk a little bit about that.
You know, eventually I got involved in immigrants' rights. I went to school. That's how I got involved in activism. I thought at that time, I thought I wanted to be an attorney because I say in the article, I was struggling with liberalism, that I was, you know, caught up in this idea if I could just get access to the system, then I could change it, not really understanding how movements work or anything like that. But I read Noam Chomsky's Latin America From Colonization to Globalization. It's a series of exchanges between him and somebody named Heinz Dietrich. He's a journalist. And so I finally learned through that book why there's so many Latin Americans in the United States. And it's because of generations and generations of kind of global North oppression in Latin America, material extortion, counter-revolution. And so it helped me to understand, for one thing, why there are so many Latin Americans here. And it helped me move past this narrative of the so-called American dream. I was very much a dreamer at that point. I guess I got my paperwork, but when I was younger, I was a dreamer. You know, for me, that was such a tired narrative because that, in my mind, that's charity, right? You're trying to appeal to people's bleeding hearts around a topic when it should be centered around some iota of justice. And so that's what that book helped me understand. And it also helped me understand that, you know, those of us from the global South came to the United States to reclaim our share of the resources that had been taken from our home countries by the global North, by the United States. And so I just stopped feeling ashamed. And really, we're just here to get our share of what the United States took from our countries.
Maybe talk a little bit about Chile, since that's your country of origin, and about the U.S. intervention there. And because I think it's a similar story in many of the Latin American countries.
So in 1973, there was very famously a coup against a democratically elected social democrat president named Salvador Allende. And so after that were many years of dictatorship. There was a U.S. Backed dictatorship, dictator who was installed. Many thousands of people were killed. It's the first 9/11, right? It happened on September 11. And so there's not Not too many Chileans came to the United States, but I think like other examples are clearly Cuba, the blockade, the US imposed blockade that's strangling Cuba, that drives a lot of the migration from the island, particularly to South Florida, right? Guatemala, there was a coup very famously in 1954, Haiti, two coups, Honduras in 2009 and El Salvador in the 80s. And so I could go on and on. There's lots of examples, not just, again, not just in Latin America, in the global South, that drives this kind of migration, right? Why these kind of opportunities aren't available in countries like Bolivia.
And what, from your perspective, is behind this repeated American intervention to suppress any kind of liberatory impulse in the global South?
Well, it's capitalism, right? It's resource extraction. There's nothing more terrifying to the United States than sovereignty, that any one of these countries in Latin America and the global South, again, would have sovereignty to use their material resources for the population, right? And so that's what happened in Chile. That's what happened in Cuba. That's what happened in so many of these countries, and why the United States poured money into these counter-revolutions.
In
And
order to basically protect the ability of US corporations to enter into those countries and extract whatever minerals, coffee, bananas, isn't there an element also of wanting to secure markets for American products?
oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you go to Panama, there's everybody. The consumption of spam is really disturbing. You see lots of, Coca-Cola in Latin America. You see lots of Nestle. I'll give you a great example. My grandparents wake up every morning and they drink, oh, that horrible instant coffee. Yeah, it's Nestle instant coffee. And it's like, you guys, we're Latin American. Like, we have access to the best coffee in the world. Why are you drinking this crap? But it's just because of that's the products that they were used to, right? There's so many examples of that. And the United States benefits twice, once in the kind of maintenance of these markets. And then the second thing is the economic benefiting from the economic forces that drive individuals to migrate from the poorest countries to the richest ones, right? And then you have this workforce that is vulnerable, right? That sometimes you can pay less. And so they benefit twofold that way.
Both from getting cheap labor, moving from the South, and being able to export their goods to markets in the global South, like this horrible instant coffee. Why is it then that people aren't consuming the locally grown coffee?
Well, when you're importing cheap US goods, you don't make very much money to begin with. It's going to drive out local businesses, of course. Also flood the market with US products.
I mean, why is Nestlé's crappy instant coffee cheaper than, nice whole beans that, the farmer down the road is selling?
Well, the flood of US goods into Latin America drives out, it just close it's just like what you have here with the Walmart, right? It forces kind of these mom and pop operations to close down.
Because they just can't compete because of their particular small operations. So part of it is economies of scale, and part of it is, I suspect, some subsidies and the trade agreements.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have, with NAFTA, for instance, you have US growers being taking their excess, what they're unable to sell, right? Corn, whatever, and then flooding rice. We saw that with Haiti, right? Haiti was flooded with rice. And actually, I heard a story recently about USAID, that it's affecting US workers because they're no longer, that was part of the program that bought that excess with them, that excess produce from them to be able to dump on these other countries.
What about the drug trade? I'm talking about the illicit drug trade. Does that drive immigration in any significant way?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, people get tired of the violence. Well, for one thing, there wouldn't be such a, like people talk about Mexico and fentanyl. Well, these markets wouldn't exist if there wasn't such a huge appetite for them in the United States. That's one thing. But like I had a friend of mine in Colombia that I met when I was able to go to college. And she told me, she's like, it just got so bad, we just couldn't even go out. Like it we would go to just a bar or whatever, and if there was a narco there, they would just, say like, "Give me your girlfriend." Illicit drugs have played various roles in Latin America. On the one hand, at times being a source of funding for revolutionary movements, but for the most part, it helps the United States. It gives the United States a reason to send a ton of what is oftentimes characterized as aid to countries like Colombia, but really in the form of paramilitary troops to be able to control the population.
What is DSA doing? How are they organizing or trying to resist those threats of deportation?
Yeah, so one more note about, I think, the fear. I will say it's kind of a fear that never goes away. Like, I have my citizenship now, but it's still really intimidating for me to just go into any government institution. Like, when I first moved to Washington State, I know I had to switch my license, right? And I just couldn't, just the thought of going into something as pretty harmless as the DMV, it just took me, I was dragging my feet to be able to do it. And I know it was because of that. But, in terms of what the response has been, I will say I've been an immigrants' rights activist for many years, including under Obama. I will be surprised if Trump deports anywhere near the level of people that Obama deported. We called him the deporter in chief. He deported so many damn people. For me, this is just Obama again. I think maybe the difference between somebody like Obama and Trump is really the rhetoric. People feel emboldened to not have to hide their feelings so much, the xenophobia that they might have maybe thought twice about. I remember the first time Trump got elected, I was in South Florida and I was working adjacent to the school system, and I heard a lot of stories about bullying, for instance. That was newer. Bullying always exists, right? You just kind of see more of it because people feel emboldened. And they're just repeating the stuff that their parents said, sadly. But anyway, to answer your question in terms of what DSA has been doing, so we've revived our immigrants' rights group. We have been training chapters on how to respond to some of this. So I personally, I could talk about Know Your Rights trainings. I do them in Florida. I've been doing them here in the Pacific Northwest. That I would recommend anybody go to, but if you work with immigrants, encourage them to attend, whether or not they're documented, because a lot of immigrants are a part of mixed status families. For instance, myself, my mom, we were undocumented, but my two cousins were born here. They were citizens, right? I had a aunt, she had her green card. My grandpa got a citizenship, so it was just mixed status. Know Your Rights clinics, I think, are the biggest. It's the most powerful thing that you can do, honestly. To protect undocumented communities, because particularly in the Pacific Northwest, it's actually not that easy to deport people. If they know to invoke their right to remain silent, you don't give a reasonable doubt to an ICE agent by continuing to talk to them, right, to answer their questions, you don't have to answer their questions. And so that's the first thing that you learn in a Know Your Rights training. So empowering people to just remain silent. And understanding that ICE needs a judicial warrant in order to enter the home, and it can't just be an administrative order. Those things like that will actually, I believe, go a long way to preventing deportations. And so locally, there's a Deportation Defense Coalition. There's lots of ways that people have responded. And so in Oregon, particularly, there's a lot of NGOs that have been doing really great work. And then also we're doing it locally with DSA too. We just
So what I hear you saying is that all the rhetoric that we've been hearing about how ICE is going to come into our churches, our homes, our schools, our hospitals, and just snatch people up, that is really more rhetoric than reality, that ICE, for a variety of reasons, logistical, legal, lack of local cooperation from law enforcement, perhaps in some jurisdictions, it's just not as easy to do as what the rhetoric maybe makes it sound like, and that what is behind all that rhetoric is trying to appease a right-wing nationalist base.
So the schools and churches thing. So under Obama, he issued a memo about safe spaces, safe locations, and so it said ICE shouldn't, should not go into schools and churches and stuff like that. Still did anyway, I could tell you. It was just more in rural areas where there wasn't quite as much community accountability, There weren't many as people watching. So it still happened under Obama. Trump revoked that it was just a memo. It's not a law or anything like that. And so he said, no, we have every right to go into schools and churches. And so that has happened. ICE getting onto school buses, ICE showing up in colleges and universities. That is happening. But again, going back to like what you need to be able to deport somebody, the ICE agent needs to have reasonable suspicion. Reasonable suspicion. And so if you don't engage with them, they won't have it. But I will say it gets a little bit messier in states where you do have cooperation of ICE with the police. And so in Washington and Oregon, it's very much the case that it is against the law for the police to be able to cooperate with ICE. And so that's huge. That's enormous in terms of preventing deportations.
So it varies quite a bit from place to place in terms of how freely ICE is going to be able to operate and how effective they're going to be.
Exactly. And it also depends on, again, going back to whether or not that person knows their rights at the end of the day.
Right. Before we close, do you want to say anything further about what DSA is pursuing as a strategy to assist immigrant communities?
Well, we can always use more help. There's the Portland DSA chapter. We have branches in Washington County and Vancouver. And so, if anybody's interested, I encourage you to join. And the more people can get involved, the better.
Thank you, Louisa, very much for joining me today and talking about your personal story.
Thank you.
Una pierna que veneno de serpiente por el camino del viento.
El día había comenzado entusiasmado y alegre.
Dice, pasaporte.
¿A dónde va por ahí, Juan Hilario, con esta noche tan fea? ¿Usted no se anima? Mire cómo está el camino. Anegadito.
That was Calle 13 in their song Pal Norte, about coming north. Before that, you heard Louisa Martinez reflecting on her past as an undocumented person. One quick note is that Nestle, with their crappy coffee, is not a U.S. corporation, but rather Swiss, which only drives home the point that exploitation of the global South is not exclusively a U.S. project. As part of its All Thrills, No Frills special programming, KABU hosted a number of shows featuring the history, art, culture, music, and politics of African Americans during Black History Month. If you missed those shows, you can still listen to them online by visiting kboo.fm/ATNF4. These include segments by The Old Mole on the African Film Fest, Surveillance in Oregon of Racial Justice Activists, Public Schools in the Making of Black Masculinity, and more. Next up, Movie Moles Fran Michel and Laurie Mercier review the film El Norte, which brings into stark relief U.S. corporate exploitation of the global South and how it drives people from their homelands.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Laurie Mercier to discuss the 1983 film El Norte. Directed and co-written by Gregory Nava, El Norte is an award-winning, independent, epic U.S. film, notable for centering the experiences of two indigenous Mayan migrants from Guatemala as they move through Mexico and come to work in Los Angeles. El Norte has been included in the U.S. National Film Registry for its historical, cultural, and aesthetic contributions, and the Criterion Collection produced a DVD version with director's commentary and other special features. The story is divided in three parts. The first takes place in Guatemala and follows the indigenous family. The father, Arturo, is killed by the army because of his organizing with fellow coffee plantation workers. The mother and most of the village is rounded up by the army, and the children, Enrique and Rosa, flee to the north. The second part takes place in Mexico as Enrique and Rosa migrate north and find a coyote to take them across the U.S. border. The last part takes place in Los Angeles and follows Enrique and Rosa as they find work, she in a sweatshop and then as a house cleaner, he in a restaurant and then as a day laborer. Lori, you're an historian and you've included this film in courses that you've taught. Let's start by reviewing the historical context of the film and what was happening in Guatemala and the U.S. when it was made in the early 1980s.
Well, the violence in Guatemala that we see hints of in the film as Enrique and Rosa are forced to flee really originates in 1954 when the United States and CIA engineered a military coup against the democratically elected president of Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz. Arbenz had threatened corporate interests due to his modest proposals to increase wages and enact land reform. After the coup, for the next 30 years, the United States continued to supply the Guatemalan military regimes with funds, equipment, and training, resulting in brutal state repression, displacement, and poverty. So in the 1980s, when the film is made, the Reagan administration had intervened to crush social movements that had arisen to protest this brutality. And the U.S.-backed Guatemalan military swept through indigenous communities, committing over 600 massacres. As the genocide unfolded, the Reagan administration continued to push for funding, and tens of thousands of mostly indigenous Guatemalans fled north. So this is when the filmmaker Gregory Nava met dozens of survivors of one of the massacres at Huehuetenango, who had sought refuge in a Los Angeles church. And he did interviews with these refugees and lots of research. And so that provides the backdrop for the film. Ultimately, the United Nations Commission for Historical Clarification reported that from 1960 to 1996, the U.S.-funded Guatemalan Civil War resulted in the deaths of over 200,000 people, and the vast majority of them were Mayan. The state and paramilitary forces committed 93% of human rights violations with a complete scorched earth policy, which ended up displacing almost half the population of Guatemala. And I could recommend to listeners the Digital National Security Archive online. It's a great resource, which actually has the declassified documents about this U.S. intervention and aiding and abetting the violence in Guatemala. And Fran, I find one of the most important elements of the film is that it reveals how migration then and now from the South is directly due to U.S. actions, whether it's supporting dictators and brutal militaries in Guatemala in the 80s or today, the crushing sanctions on countries like Venezuela and Cuba. And throughout the decades, the system of global capitalism that forces workers and farmers to move in order to survive. So, Fran, what did you find most compelling about El Norte?
There are so many very compelling things about this film. I first saw it when it came out 40 years ago, and having not seen it again until recently, there are still scenes seared into my memory. It's quite a striking and memorable film. Nava, as you say, developed it in conjunction with Guatemalan immigrants who he met in California. He had grown up on the border in California from a Mexican-American family and had relatives on both sides. And initially, he wanted to make this film that would humanize immigrants. And initially, it was going to be about Mexican immigrants in order to humanize the immigrants who were providing so much of the labor on which Americans depended, but who were not necessarily seen, who weren't recognized as people. But then he met all of these Guatemalan immigrants and learned more about that story. And so he pushed the story further back, both further south into Guatemala, where there was this, all of these massacres ultimately recognized as a genocide funded and fueled by the United States, but also back into indigenous experience. The story also draws on imagery from the Popol Vuh, the pre-Columbian Mayan epic, that has dual protagonists, the main characters in that are twins. There's a lot of sun and moon imagery. There's a lot of circular imagery. So he's drawing on a wealth of cultural references that go back before the invasion of the Americas, but also drawing on, you know, work by Diego Rivera and other artists.
And the magical realism of Latin American writers.
Yes, the dream realism he talks about in the commentary on the film. There are some sort of magical moments, especially in the first part of the film, where it's not, there isn't a distinguishing between dream and waking. Everything sort of blends together smoothly. There's a scene where Rosa comes into her house and the house is filled with white butterflies, which are a symbol of death. And it's just a very beautiful image. And there's no reason to think that it's not real, except that it's a weird thing to have that many white butterflies in a house. But it's not separated off. And then later on, some of the more surreal and dreamlike imagery is more clearly distinguished as happening in the character's dreams rather than in waking life. And waking life becomes much more cold and much less beautiful. And the scenes, especially at the beginning, are quite beautiful. And that is something that Nava has also talked about, the importance of lighting things properly for people with brown skin. And I think of also the filmmaker Julie Dash, who made Daughters of the Dust, having talked about the importance of using a different kind of lighting technique when you're filming black skin, or in the case of El Norte, when you're filming olive-toned and brown skin, that the kinds of lighting techniques developed for white people just don't work as well when you're looking at people with darker skin. And so, I mean, there are sort of subtle things like that that really add to the beauty of the film. So some of that is I think, really important and part of the aesthetic and emotional experience of the film. It brings us much closer to the characters.
You know, now that you mention it, it seems like the beginning of the film that's set in Guatemala is more dreamlike, and the lighting is much different than when Rosa and Enrique are traveling north through Mexico and then to the United States, where the lighting becomes more harsh, symbolizing the cold reality of the capitalism in the El Norte, which requires a much more brutal form of labor than the scenes from picking coffee in Guatemala. Yeah. I mean, which also had its own brutality, but clearly the filmmaker is trying to make this distinction between the different places that they travel and exist.
And yet there are also these parallels, visually and conceptually, right? That the whole film is taking place within the circuits of capitalist labor relations. There's a real strong parallel in the composition and the framing of early scenes when Enrique and his father are picking coffee on the plantation under the eye of the foreman. And then a later scene when Enrique is working on a construction site in Los Angeles and he's digging a ditch. And again, he's lined up with other workers and he's under the eye of a foreman. And there's a kind of return to the same set of relations, although not in this beautiful setting that his father tells him early in the film, you know, this is good land. And that's why they've taken it, because it's good land. So I mean, there are differences, but there are also these parallels from what happens at the beginning and what happens later, because it's all happening in relation to capitalist exploitation of the poor, of the workers, whether they're picking coffee or digging ditches.
The other strong features of the film, I find, is that, you know, the ending is not a happy one. In contrast to so many rags to riches immigrant stories in American literature and what few films exist about the immigrant stories. But the film clearly is making this commentary on the violence at the heart of American capitalism. And, you know, that remains today one of the strong features of the film, about how the bosses, whether the woman who's hiring domestics or the restaurant owner or the textile executive with their global system of sweatshops, they might be clueless or arrogant and privileged, but they hold the lives of Enrique and Rosa in their hands, creating this tension through the film that also has relevance today. It's familiar to all of those going through their own migrant or immigrant experience today.
Yeah, the film really doesn't buy into the illusory sort of rags to riches story, just as it doesn't give us an Anglo protagonist. In trying to fund the film, you know, one of the offers they got was basically if you had an Anglo star, which is how most such stories had been framed, right? The white reporter who comes in and exposes the terrible experiences of the suffering masses. Whereas here, it's the immigrants themselves. We don't need the intermediary figure of the white savior, white reporter figure. And it's striking that ultimately the film was partly funded by, I mean, this is another marker of how much things have changed, but it was partly funded by PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which I don't think is likely to fund anything like it these days. So, I mean, times have really changed, and not for the better.
But I think the filmmakers did struggle with funding, and they did have to make a few compromises, not to be explicitly critical of the U.S. role in the genocide or in the agribusiness in Guatemala. And I think that points to this continuity between, you know, any film today or then that tries to make a serious critique runs into trouble, not only with fundraising, but in distribution. And initially, this film had difficulty finding a distributor, just as current films, including the documentary winner of the Academy Award, the Palestine film that has still not been able to find a distributor in the United States. So, you know, clearly this is a reminder about how film in the United States is limited by, again, these capitalist forces that determine what we see, what stories are elevated and which are hidden or censored. Do we want to say something, Fran, about how the border crossing has changed since the 1980s? I mean, it seems important just since Trump recently made it practically impossible for migrants who arrive at the border to obtain any kind of asylum. This was the case in the 1980s as a million Salvadorans and Guatemalans came to the United States fleeing the violence that the United States was supporting, and only 2% of them received asylum. But there was this social movement in the United States, the sanctuary movement, the anti-war movement against Reagan's policies in Central America that resulted in the Boland Amendment, and also the 1986 immigration law that did grant asylum to Central American refugees. I mean, what do we see as different today than the 1980s and efforts to migrate north?
There are many, many differences. The characters in the film enter the U.S. ultimately by crawling through a tunnel. And that is a detail that Nava learned of from someone who had done that, had entered the country by crawling through one of these abandoned tunnels, which after the film got blocked up so that no one could get in that way. There are scenes of the border fence in the film. It was a chain link fence with some barbed wire on top, much easier to get through than the kind of apparatus that's there now. And I think maybe most striking, the INS and the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the Border Patrol cooperated with the filmmakers in making this movie because they wanted to improve their image. They were a little worried that people thought they weren't humane enough, which is clearly not a worry that their successor organizations have at this point. But they just said, well, you know, don't show a drawn gun when they're being arrested by INS. And they actually filmed inside an INS facility where they're being interviewed before they're sent back. They're sent back to Mexico because someone has given them the advice to pretend to be Mexican. So they're not sent all the way back to Guatemala. So they have to learn to curse like Mexicans. And that works. But it's an awful experience for them coming north. And yet it's clearly much worse now for people who are trying to make that kind of journey.
You know, something else I might mention, I can't resist, is just how we see in the 1980s, even though the Republicans were in dominance, the Democratic Party seemed to have more of a backbone. And we see this in 1984 with the Reagan-Walter Mondale debate, where Mondale actually criticized Reagan and questioned him about his Central American policies that were killing so many people in Central America. So it's hard to imagine. I mean, now the Democratic Party seems to be the party of war, just like the Republican Party, and, you know, not advocating for immigrants like many in the Democratic Party were back in the 1980s. So I would see that as another change. So Fran, where can people access this film?
Well, it's available to rent on several streaming sites, and you can browse around depending on which ones you have access to. You can stream it for free on the Internet Archive, although it doesn't have subtitles, so you kind of need to know Spanish and Quiche, as well as English, in order to understand the film from that venue. And it's available on DVD at the Multnomah County Library, and they have the Criterion Edition with all the bells and whistles and beautiful digital transfer. So you can get it at the library, you can find it online. It's really worth finding. It's a beautiful film. It has funny moments, and it's very moving, and it's historically, culturally, aesthetically significant and important and relevant still today.
Absolutely relevant 40 years later. So we highly recommend that listeners go out and find El Norte. Even if you saw it 40 years ago, it's worth seeing again, especially this new Criterion version that Fran described. And this is Laurie Mercier and Fran Michelle for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Recommending El Norte.
Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Soy una fábrica de humo, mano de obra campesina para tu consumo. Frente de frío en el medio del verano, el amor en los tiempos del cólera, mi hermano. El sol que nace y el día que muere, con los mejores atardeceres. Soy el desarrollo en carne viva, un discurso político sin saliva. Las caras más bonitas que he conocido, soy la fotografía de un desaparecido, la sangre dentro de tus venas. Soy un pedazo de tierra que vale la pena una canasta con frijoles. Soy Maradona contra Inglaterra, anotándote dos goles. Soy lo que sostiene mi bandera, la espina dorsal del planeta en mis cordilleras. Soy lo que me enseñó mi padre, el que no quiere a su patria, no quiere a su madre. Soy América Latina, un pueblo sin pierna, pero que camina. Oye,
tú no puedes comprar al viento, tú no puedes comprar al sol.
That was another clip from Calle 13 called Latino America, a celebration of Latin American diversity. Before that, Fran Michelle and Laurie Mercier reviewed the award-winning film El Norte. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I want to remind you that KBOO is hosting its annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming now through April 15. Check out the schedule at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And please, if you can, donate to KBOO to keep community radio alive in Portland. To close our show, I'm going to read excerpts from an essay entitled The United States is Not a Nation of Immigrants, published in the Boston Review on August 16, 2021. That essay itself was taken from Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Exclusion. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is an historian, writer, and professor emeritus in ethnic studies at California State University. She writes, "The United States has never been a nation of immigrants. It has always been a settler state with a core of descendants from the original colonial settlers, primarily Anglo-Saxons, Scots, Irish, and Germans. The vortex of settler colonialism sucked immigrants through a kind of seasoning process of Americanization, not as rigid and organized as the seasoning of Africans, which rendered them into human commodities, but effective nevertheless. In the 1960s, U.S. historians were having to adjust the historical narrative of the White Republic in response to Black civil rights demands for a reckoning about racism. But in the process of those adjustments and reforms, the settler state was never a subject of debate. As Mahmoud Mamdani writes, If America's greatest social successes have been registered on the frontier of race, the same cannot be said of the frontier of colonialism. If the race question marks the cutting edge of American reform, the native question highlights the limits of that reform. End quote. Attempts to quote-unquote include Native peoples as victims of racism further camouflage settler colonialism and constitutes a type of social genocide. The U.S. polity has been trying to rid itself of indigenous nations since first settlement. 400 years later, multiculturalism is the mechanism for avoiding acknowledgement of settler colonialism. Multiculturalism requires a revised narrative of U.S. history. For this scheme to work and to affirm U.S. historical progress, indigenous nations had to be somehow woven into the story. As territory and treaty-based peoples in North America, they do not fit the grid of multiculturalism, but were included by transforming them into an inchoate, oppressed racial group. The trend of quote-unquote third world immigration began with the 1965 immigration law, but accelerated with the Western nations' retreat from funding and supporting decolonization and nation building, which in turn accelerated debt, austerity, and famine abroad, and in the case of the United States, fronting and arming counterinsurgencies to prevent authentic self-determination, making the countries of origin unlivable. When migrants move, it's not out of idle fancy, or because they hate their homelands, or to plunder the countries they come to. They move because the accumulated burdens of history have rendered their homelands less and less habitable. The United States has not acted lawfully with other nations, including the Native American nations on its soil, through most of the 19th and 20th centuries. How can it now expect the human victims of that enormous illegality to obey the laws of the United States and stay home or wait 30 years for a visa to rejoin their families? Moroccan Muslim immigrant Leila Lalami, a prize-winning novelist, writer, and university professor, aptly titled her 2020 book, Conditional Citizens on Belonging in America. Lalami relates that she had no trouble with the citizenship test because she had taken courses on U.S. history, had studied its literature, and had become acquainted with the culture. She discovered quickly on arrival in the United States, however, that Americans knew nothing of her country's history or culture, although they knew the racist caricatures of Arabs and Muslims. As an immigrant, a woman, an Arab, and a Muslim, Lalami was made to feel like a conditional citizen. Lalami insightfully discusses the U.S. 19th century programs to erase the languages, cultures, and social relations practiced by indigenous peoples. She is alert to that process of Americanization being demanded of immigrants to the United States as well. But while making common cause between immigrants, especially immigrants of color, and Native Americans, she does not interrogate the role of immigrants in perpetuating settler colonialism. Dean Itouji Serranilio writes that migration to a settler colonial state is fraught because native land and resources, quote, are under political, ecological, and spiritual contestation, end quote, which means that immigrant communities can duplicate a colonial system initiated by white settlers. Without consciousness of and resistance to the pull of Americanism, the migrant can passively contribute to the continued settler colonial order. The desire to relieve the non-European migrant or descendants of enslaved Africans from responsibility is understandable, but not sustainable if the settler colonial foundation is to be eradicated. That is, the decolonization of the entire apparatus of the settler state. What would that entail? U.S. social movement organizer Claire Bayard captured the dilemma for most non-indigenous activists, saying, The difficulty that a lot of non-Native people have in imagining what unsettling would look like in this country is that it's not seen as a political possibility. We can't even imagine what that would look like. End quote. Immigrants and refugees from U.S. wars have an important role to play if there is to be change. Viet Thanh Nguyen observes that identity politics is treated as a slur, something to be avoided. It appears to be the one thing that many on the left and the solid right agree on. Nguyen writes, "To have no identity at all is the privilege of whiteness, which is the identity that pretends not to have an identity, that denies how it is tied to capitalism, to race, and to war." End quote. He calls on minorities to dissent from the terms that a regime of whiteness offers. Quote, "They must call forth anger and rage, demand solidarity and revolution, critique whiteness, domination, power, and all the faces of the war machine. And in particular for Southeast Asians, they who must insist that the war that defines them in America is not only their war, but a war made by white people, a war that is not an aberration, but a manifestation of a war machine that would prefer refugees to think that their stories are immigrant stories. We must also tell the war stories that made ghosts and made us ghosts, the war stories that brought us here." I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your well-read red, and I've been reading excerpts from Not a Nation of Immigrants, Settler Colonialism, White Supremacy, and a History of Erasure and Exclusion by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. A link to a longer version of this essay, published in Boston Review, can be found on the webpage for this segment. That's a wrap for our show today. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. I want to thank Moles, Fran Michelle, and Laurie Mercier for their movie review, and thanks to our guest, Luisa Martinez, for sharing her personal story. One last reminder about this year's All Frills, No Frills special programming through April 15 on KBOO Portland. You can check it out at kboo.fm/ATNF4 and listen online to shows you might have missed for Black History Month, International Women's Day, Mardi Gras Rock and Roll, and other musical marathons. Remember, too, that KBOO is only on the air because of support from listeners like you. I'm going to leave you today with a song by La Santa Cecilia called Ice el Hielo, about living in constant fear of deportation. Thanks for listening, and stay active. Our resistance is all we can count on.
Ice, water frozen solid. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE, El Hielo.
Iba pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar, no sea cosa que la acuse